it was such a success that we thought we'd try it again. And if this is a success, it might become a permanent fixture. So, my job is certainly to welcome you, and of course I do welcome you. I know that some of you have come huge distances coming here today, so a very warm welcome from us, from me and from all the committee down here, who've worked really, really hard to put on this day, actually. But my job is also to introduce the topic, causes and reasons. So I'm just going to spend 10 minutes talking about causation, talking about reasons, and talking about the relation between them in order to set the day out for you. The question of causation is one of the most vexed questions in philosophy. Leibniz, for example, thought it didn't exist at all, and there are other people who thought it didn't exist. Leibniz believed that, what's happening here? You think that I'm pressing the switch and it's causing the lights to come on and off. Is that not right? Is that what you think?
Yes.
Okay. Leibniz would think that what's happening is I'm pressing the switch and the lights are going off. And that's because this is the best of all worlds. This is the world in which what happens is what you expect to happen, because this is a good world. I'm not being fair to Leibniz. Actually, his arguments for this are much better than you might imagine from hearing the conclusion without the arguments. So, there's a question right from the beginning as to whether causation exists at all. But if it does, then that you might think there's one thing we can be pretty sure of about the nature of causation, and that is that it's a relation. Okay, it's a relation between two things. In that case, my pressing the switch and the lights going on or off. So if it's a relation, what you're interested in is the nature of causation, what is causation like? You've got two elements to look at. You've got the relata of the causal relation, what it is that's actually related by the relation of causation. Then you've got the relation itself. Okay? So there's the relata and the relation that relates them. So what are the relata of the causal relation? Well, the philosophical literature on this would fill this room. Just on what are the relata of the causal relation. So, for example, are they facts, or states of affairs, or events, or things, or properties of things? And then, of course, there's the question, well, if they're events, what are events? Are they Kim events, i.e. events as Yagwon Kim understands them, which is things having a property at a time? So that's one event, but then the things having the same property at a different time is another event, and so on. And then are events and states of affairs the same sort of thing? So states of affairs are simply enduring events. Okay, so wherever you look on this, if you think the relata of the causal relation are facts, you have to ask what a fact is. And I'll tell you, actually, literature on facts would fill this room. Are they events? In that case, what is an event? Are they properties? In which case, what are properties? And so on. And we haven't even got on to what the relation of causation is at the moment. So let's move on to the relation of causation. What sort of relation is it? Well, okay, famously, Hume thought it... famously, but arguably... this is the wrong view to attribute to Hume, but most people think that Hume holds a regularity view of causation, which is that there is no more to causation than a relation in our minds. So you see me pressing the switch, and therefore you expect the light to go on or off, and it's that expectation that you call causation. Well, if there is no more to causation than that regularity, surely you might want to say that what Hume is actually saying is like Leibniz, causation doesn't really exist. There's no more to causation than our expectations, which we've acquired as a result of seeing lots of people press switches and lights go on at the same time. So you might think there isn't a card you can put between Leibniz and Hume on this. Other people say that Hume didn't actually hold that view. Galen Strawson, for example, believes that what Hume was saying when he said that was not, there is no more to causation than regularity, but we can't know anything about causation except regularity. In other words, that it's through regular correlations between events or facts or things and there, or whatever you like, that we learn to understand causation, or we learn what causes what. But the relation itself is forever and in principle beyond our ken. So there's a real relation, but we can't know it. So this is a bit like the Kantian idea that objects in the world are out there, they exist, but we can't know what they are independently of ourselves, because of course we need our senses to see these objects, etc. So causation exists, it really is out there, and we know of it through seeing correlations between the relata, but we can't know the causal relation as it is in itself. So they have a very realist view of causation and also a very non-realist view of causation, both being attributed to the same chap, Hume. And so you should notice that there are epistemological and metaphysical issues here, and I don't have to explain that, do I, in this company, because do we all know, or would you like me to explain it? Epistemological is to do with the knowledge of causation, metaphysics is to do with the nature of causation. So we might want to concern ourselves with how we know that A causes B, or we might want to concern ourselves with what it is for A to cause B. Two quite separate, in principle separate questions. Obviously the answers to them will be hugely interdependent. So those are all issues to do with causation. The other side of today's topic is reasons. Now, reasons, there was a long tradition before about 1960, 1970 of thinking that reasons couldn't be causes. Why couldn't they be causes? is that water mine? Right? I'll be fine with it. Why can't reasons be causes? Answer, because another thing we know for sure about causation is that it's law governed. It's regular. Even if there is singular causation, we think that there are laws behind it. But reasons are not like that. If I think, well, you've heard me use this example before, crossing road in order to get an ice cream, yes. That doesn't mean that the next time Ray wants an ice cream, he's going to cross the road. It looks as if human action, not human behaviour, but human action, is not law-governed. Now, if that is the case, that means that the reason explanations we use, the explanations which cite reasons for someone's acting are not causal explanations. They're not explanations that cite causes for action. Now, if that's true, reasons can't be causes. And what we're looking at is two different types of motivating force, if you like. There's event causation, which is completely mindless and which exists and is as it is quite independently of us. And then there's agent causation, and I hesitate to use that word because there's a huge, the literature for that would fill this whole building, never mind just this room. But there's something that moves agents, and it's not the same as event causation. That was the thought. Then Davidson came along, 1963, wrote Actions, Reasons and Causes. And he says, actually, we're making a mistake here because there are laws governing human action. But actually, the only way we can get to these laws is through reason explanation. And the paper that he wrote was massively, massively influential because it started everyone thinking, of course reasons are causes. Of course, they're causes, they're just causes of a slightly different kind. So that started a whole industry of showing how reasons can be causes and how reason, causation, causation itself can come together. There are huge difficulties, not least in the regularity point of view, and recently people have started, and this is really is fairly recently, within the last 10 years, people have started questioning again whether reasons are causes, and holes have been picked in Davidson's argument, and again we're back to the idea that human action isn't caused, i.e. that reasons are not causes. So, we can separate these two things, the question of what causation is, the question of what reasons are, and we've done that a bit today. So in the morning we're going to be talking about causes and causation, and in the afternoon we're going to be talking about reasons and reasoning and agent causation and so on. But in the discussion we'll also have a chance to bring them together, and I think someone at the end will bring them together. So I'll just hand you straight over to Alan Bailey to start the day.
Thank you, Marianne. Stick your hand up at the back if you can't hear me, but I hope I'll get through. Marianne has covered the first paragraph or so of my handout, and I don't know if any of you saw the Stoppard joke about philosophy. Apparently the mathematics department in the university is the second cheapest, because the only equipment it needs is pencils, papers and waste paper baskets. But the philosophy department's the cheapest because it doesn't even need waste paper baskets. I wanted to start with causes this morning because clearly the whole day is about the relationship, as Marion was saying, between causes and reasons. But the clash seems to me to come partly because of this notion of causal necessity, that causes are somehow force things to be as they are, and we therefore ought to see what this amounts to and what this notion of causal necessity is, which has been a great subject for philosophical discussion for a very long time, and see how we might reconcile that or where we finish up on that. So I'm starting in a position of the Humean that Marion was describing, who doesn't see any need for this extra thing, causal necessity, behind the regularities we observe. Eileen will be taking the opposite view with Kripke and co, arguing for something real called causal necessity. And we'll have a bit of discussion about that, we thought, before lunch, to see where we finish, or not finish, but where we stand by lunchtime on that question, if anywhere, in order to apply that to the issue of reasons, which may or may not conflict with that, in the afternoon. So I'm going to talk till coffee time, and there might be a moment or two for specific questions, but I'll try and get through what I wanted to say within this half hour, and then we'll take the main discussion after Eileen has spoken. Strawson, Galen Strawson is where I was starting from, which is why I've used the word flukes in my title, because he challenges the regularity theory, whether or not Hume held it. Indeed, he argues that Hume didn't hold it, and the title of his book is Secret Connection, because he quotes from Hume, "Experience only teaches us how one event constantly follows another without instructing us in the secret connection which binds them together and renders them inseparable." So that is where I'm starting, as Marion was starting. The only point I make on Marion's exposition is that Strawson uses the word ontology, where she was using the word metaphysics. Ontology being what actually is, as opposed to the epistemology, what we can know. Strawson, as I've said in the handout S1, agrees with the regularity thing in terms of direct experience. We can only observe causation as regular succession and nothing more. Regularity theory in epistemological terms. But he then makes two further claims, one which is interesting that I don't propose to say much more about now, which is that our experience is then intellect enhanced in a way laid down by evolution into a concept of power or force such that regularity cannot be other than it is. So this is built up a perception of these regularities which involves the concept of power or force, which we have been evolved to see as part of the notion. Now that seems to be interesting, and we might come back to, and part of the notion of compulsion I was introducing earlier. But the further point that Strawson makes, which is what I want to discuss, is S3. This concept reflects reality. Causation is not just regularity, but there is something which is the reason for the regularity, such that it cannot be other than it is. Now that is where the Humeans, with or without Hume, part company from the exponents of causal necessity. This is a kind of argument which is fairly familiar, which I believe is called a transcendental form of argument, of which I've listed a few at the end of the first page in the handout. One which seems to me rather a good argument, no experience without an experiencer, which is quoted in the other Galen Strawson book, admirable book about mental reality, where he calls it Frege's thesis, and it seems to me pretty sound. It's quite difficult to argue against that, though I've been having some worries about dreams, but anyway, we'll leave that one side. The next one is the one we're on, no causal regularity without something which is a reason for the regularity, but I put in a couple more. No natural laws without a lawgiver, which has been seen to be a powerful argument for the existence of God, but seems to me to be a rather obvious misunderstanding of the use of the word law in one case as delivered by an institutional person as a lawgiver, and in the other case natural law, which is observable regularity, and I shall continue to argue nothing more. So it doesn't seem to be much force in that argument. Similarly, no creation without a creator. Well, you might hope to make that run for ordinary things happening, creation in the ordinary sense, but see, if we're talking about Big Bang, how can we possibly know that it needs a creator behind it? What could the creator be? And so on. It doesn't seem to me to amount to much as an argument. So my conclusion on the first page was that this kind of metaphysical argument is not hopeless, but it does need careful examination, which is what I'm hoping to give it in the next 20 minutes. So what Strawson is saying is that the only alternative to his view that there is a reason for the regularity such that it cannot be other than it is, S3, the only alternative is that regularity is a complete and continuous fluke. And he argues this passionately and at length, and to give you a flavour of it, I thought I'd read you a bit of where it is focused on, in particular the view where we all accept that there is a reality involving physical objects, that they are as real as anything could be, and he says there's something particularly wonderfully absurd about the regularity theory of causation when it's conjoined with a solidly realist conception of the world. For then, one is presented with all these massive physical objects out there in space-time, behaving in perfectly regular ways, and one is told that there is, quite definitely, no reason at all for this regularity. Absolutely nothing about the nature of reality which is a reason why it continues to be regular in the particular way in which it is regular, moment after moment, eon after eon. It is, in that clear sense, a pure fluke. Well, this is argued in very broad general terms in the Strawson book, it seems to me, and he doesn't make the move which is fairly standard, I think, in modern philosophical discussion, which is to look at singular causal statements about individual events causing individual events. Marion says it is events, or it doesn't matter. That's what I'm going to focus on. Because if you remember when Hugh Miller came to talk to us, I wonder if it was a year or two ago, he was saying that these singular causal events, or sequences of events, are basic, and that the broad causal generalizations follow from them. So we better understand what these singular causal sequences of events amount to, and what we're saying, it amounts to say that A caused B, if we're wanting to know what is, quote, the nature of causation in grand general terms. So I've listed in P1 to 3 a few standard singular causal statements. The light switch causing the light to go on is the first. The billiard ball A rolling into billiard ball B so that B goes into the pocket. Absolutely stock stuff. But if we're thinking what is the reason behind those, it's pretty obvious that we're inclined to think of them as having a reason lying behind the individual event, sequence of events, namely that somebody set it up to work like that. So there is a reason, because these are man-made causal sequences. But let's go to the P3, that lightning strike individual event caused this forest fire following event, sequence of events. There isn't a single man-made reason lying behind that event. So what is it that would make this singular causal statement true? Now we have to agree immediately that it isn't just that there is this sequence. A was followed by B, because it could have been a coincidence, a fluke. It could have happened because of, it doesn't matter, something else. The lightning struck, but the burning glass was sitting there, and the fire started because the glass was burning it, and the lightning didn't have anything to do with it, or the picnicker, or in principle, by nothing at all. I mean, it may just have been spontaneous combustion, as far as that goes. So the fact that A, the lightning, was followed by B, the fire, doesn't in itself entail the lightning caused the fire. And there must be something else. And of course there are coincidences. I mean, these may not be very plausible ones, but coincidences do exist in the world. If I meet you walking around St. John's Garden or somewhere, have a reason, let's leave out reasons. There's a causal account for you being there, there's a causal account for me being there, but there may not be any causal account for us happening to meet. By definition, excluded it by saying happened to me. It was accidental, it was a fluke. So there are such things as coincidences as opposed to causal sequences. So what distinguishes them? Well, I want to argue that at least to tell the difference between A caused B and A was accidentally followed, coincidentally followed by B, a fluke, you have to be able to say at the first that A caused B, that if A hadn't happened, B would not have happened. A, in the jargon, is a necessary condition for B. But that doesn't get you very far, because the Strawsonians, anyone wanting to argue for a causal necessity, will say, well, what does this counterfactual conditional, if A hadn't happened, B wouldn't have happened, actually amount to? What lies behind it? And in a way we do want to say that it is something about the world, but A caused B, and there was this extra fact beyond A happening and B happening, namely that A was the cause of B. And it's not just something in our minds. There must be something about the world which makes this true. And I think we can't discount that view, clearly. The fact of the regularity of the world is pretty important, and you know, we wouldn't be here if it weren't. And so there is, I think, that could be the feeling which makes Strawson want to say there is something which is the reason for the regularity. But it is a rather strange kind of fact. Now we're down at this micro level. This counterfactual conditional, if A hadn't happened, B wouldn't have happened, doesn't look like the kind of thing that you will go around the corner and see. Well, of course, we know that we aren't going to observe anything beyond the regularity. Are there really counterfactual facts? And the trouble with even a simple causal statement is that it implies lots of facts, counterfactuals of all kinds. If I put a couple in, a negative fact: if the brushwood had been wetter, the fire wouldn't have happened. And a counterfactual double negative: if the wind hadn't been blowing so hard, the fire wouldn't have happened. So you're requiring somehow there to be something in the world which lies behind all these indefinite range of counterfactuals. Is this a comfortable feeling position to be in? Well, obviously it isn't. What can we say about it? And I want to say that it isn't quite so mysterious. If you see these counterfactuals as deferred predictions, in other words, if you want to say, if the lightning hadn't struck at time T2, that's the H1 down here, the fire now burning at T3 would not have happened. That's giving it a time relationship in the causal, singular causal statement, or rather the counterfactual which lies behind the singular causal statement. But that, it seems to me, is simply to say that, or perhaps not simply to say, but anyway, it entails saying that at some earlier time, T1, it was then true that if the lightning doesn't strike at some future time, T2, then the fire will not happen at that later time, T3. So it is only, it seems to me, a counterfactual and therefore perhaps a mysterious statement after the contrary has happened. Before that time, it was a straightforward predictive hypothetical statement which would be verified or falsified when the time comes. Now, that is as far as I could get in demystifying. And I should say, when I produced a version of this and showed it to Marianne some little time ago, she said, well, I don't think you really understand singular causal statements. So I had to do some more work, which is why in the middle of page 3 we get to Davidson, the sacred, what somebody called the Davidsonic boom. I saw. because I read Davidson on Event and Cause and could see that there was more to be said, I still think, fitting with my account as far as it goes, you will have to be glad that it's far enough. And just to show how I was still thinking about it and hadn't got it straight when I produced the handout, I want to take D2 before D1. So D2 is quite a long account of a singular causal statement about a single sequence, a causal sequence of events. Supposing it's claimed that the lighting of this match was caused by the striking of the match, sorry, the match lights, because it struck. The inevitable comment, since Mill anyway, is that striking may have been part of the cause, but hardly sufficient. It may be a necessary condition, but not a sufficient condition for the lighting, since it was also necessary for the match to be dry, of enough oxygen, etc. That indefinite range of counterfactuals I was talking about, of things that, if they had not been the case, it wouldn't have happened. This comment is, in my view, he says, confused. For since this match was dry, and was struck in enough oxygen, etc., the striking of this match was identical with the striking of a dry match in enough oxygen, all the conditionals having been fulfilled. So the event which is reported in the singular causal statement, if fully described, understood, would include a sufficient set of those necessary conditions of which we pick out one as, quotes, the cause. And that does seem to me a very handy insight to get over this problem of, or at least to unpack this notion of singular causes. And it retains the idea that, because there are an indefinite number of features of that event, this idea of an indefinitely extensible range of conditions, which obviously, as people have wrestled with in trying to make a comprehensive account of causal statements, So I think that's important, that singular statements may pick out a specific, do pick out a specific description of the event. But the event itself had all the features which made it sufficient as the cause of event B that followed it. Firm ground, perhaps. Anyway, Davison summarizes the position, as I've said in D1. Singular causal statements entail no law, but, he says, they entail there is a law. Actually, I've abbreviated that. It was Ducasse said, was right in saying singular causal statements entail no law. Hume was right in saying that they entail there is a law. We are all the time dealing with these regularities, law-like regularities, Davison is saying that any specific singular causal statement entails that there is a law lying behind it, a set of law-like regularities. I do, though, wonder whether it's a bit strong to say that A cause B entails there is a law such as A cause B, because it's, as I've been emphasising, quite difficult to state the law. You can state A cause B and be pretty happy that that is a comprehensive, as I said, satisfactory causal statement. But if for every time you said that, you had to say, well, there is a law which covers all these things, and for that, that is what made A cause B. It seems to me you are making you are, on that account, making a definite statement about a law, which is not the same as saying there's a singular instance of causation, because, as I've said boringly, repetitively, the law is not a law, it's an indefinitely extensible set of necessary conditions which together prove sufficient for event B. Further than that, it may, as we all know, be not just necessary conditions such of an all or nothing character, but some of the conditions may make it more probable that A is followed by B. And that idea of statistical probability, which is clearly important in an awful lot of scientific, quotes, causal explanation, is again, beyond the simple suggestion that a singular causal statement entails that there is a law. So it is, of course, a great deal more complicated than that. And I still think that in this area we have a good account of singular causal statements, and therefore of the generalizations of those singular statements into general statements. And so I ask, where is the unknowable causal power or natural necessity, which is the reason that Strawson said must lie behind? You can see what he is saying, and I realise in this account I haven't been entirely fair to Strawson's argument. He is saying that at any given time, like now, there is a regularity up to now, and if there were no causal necessity, no reason for things being as they are, such that they cannot be other than they are, we could, the next minute, might turn out to be completely different. The familiar inductive problem, we can conceive of all these regularities breaking down, because, he would say, so far, the whole sequence of events up to now could be, on his view, either either backed by some kind of causal necessity, reason for why they were as they were, or it would be a complete and continuous fluke, so that it's all accidental up to now, and anything could happen from now on. And so he is saying there must be this reason lying behind the regularity up to now, which will continue, or at least that regularity is is what makes it, what contrasts the actual situation with the conceivable situation of a continuous fluke which could break down next moment. I mean, I won't say, but the regularity, this is a familiar problem induction, the regularity is what we have observed, gives us very strong reason for assuming it will continue. This is the predictability which causation is all about, and why should we want to postulate something unknowable behind these regularities to reassure us that it's not all a huge accident? Strawson himself recognizes the possible view that in the final analysis we have no more reason to suppose there is some reason in the nature of things for the regularity than that there is not. The thing to do on this view is to decline to speculate either way. Some may challenge the very intelligibility of the idea that there is a correct answer, since the issue is undecidable. Well, I don't know how that argument strikes you. I see that there is a possibility of backing off like this. As he says, it is a possible view. And a revealing footnote, which I've also put in the end of the handout, in the Strawson book, quotes the Wittgenstein rhetorical question in Philosophical Investigations. Wouldn't a nothing serve just as well as the something about which nothing could be said or known? And the footnote ends after the quote, no. But I don't know. I mean, you'll have to decide for yourselves. I find myself unclear why it wouldn't do as well. Indeed, on the contrary, I think it does better. Not only can one quote the Tractatus, as I did here, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. Darüber muss man schweigen, I remember in German. But you could quote Occam, you know, why multiply these entities when we can get by on regularity? So I will just summarise. I hope that we shall go on exploring this after the break, and we can have a discussion about it and see where people stand, but that at least I hope I've outlined a possible view, because, as I repeat, this seems to me very relevant to the way we think about reasons as against causes. If there is no such thing as a causal necessity such that the regularity cannot be other than it is, then we may feel that a causal account and an account in terms of reasons are in some way easier to reconcile. But that's for this afternoon. Thank you. Would anyone... I must have rushed. We have 2 minutes before coffee. I apologise if I did. Anyone want to ask a quick question, or shall we go and have coffee and finish up? Okay, thanks very much.